This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. In this half of the show, we're listening back to Terry's 2011 interview with Brad Pitt, whose movie Moneyball is now out on DVD. Pitt was nominated for a Golden Globe as Best Actor for his starring role in Moneyball, and is a good bet to snag an Oscar nomination as well. Moneyball is adapted from the best-selling nonfiction book by Michael Lewis about Billy Beane, the general manager of the Oakland A's baseball team. Pitt's many other movies include Tree of Life, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Inglourious Basterds, Burn After Reading, Ocean's 11, Seven, Fight Club, Legends of the Fall, and Thelma and Louise. When Moneyball begins, Billy Beane recognizes that his team doesn't have the money the big teams like the Yankees do, and therefore he can't compete in bidding wars for star players. Beane decides to use statistical analysis to figure which players have the assets his team needs. And he ends up going after players that other managers consider too old, too injured, or too mediocre. But Beane believes he understands their unique talents and knows how to put them to use. Let's start with a scene from Moneyball. Beane, played by Brad Pitt, has recruited a numbers-crunching economist from Yale, played by Jonah Hill, to conduct statistical analyses of players. Based on that, they've started trading players and changing the lineup, but without informing the field manager, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. Here, the three of them meet before a game.
All right, you got a minute?
Yeah. Take a seat.
You can't start paying your first tonight. You'll have to start Hatterberg.
Yeah, I don't want to go 15 rounds, Billy. The lineup card is mine, and that's all.
Okay, the lineup card is definitely yours. I'm just saying you can't start paying it first.
Well, I am starting him at first.
I don't think so. He plays for Detroit now.
You traded Pena?
Brad Pitt, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to make?
Thank you.
Why did you want to make this movie, Moneyball?
Several reasons. I first picked up the book by Michael Lewis and was taken with these guys who, out of necessity, had to challenge conventional wisdom of their industry. I never looked at sports from the economic standpoint, and they are a team. We deal with the Oakland A's in 2002, and they are a team who had a payroll of $38 million to platoon a team, and they're playing against teams that have $120 million with another $100 million in reserves. And there is no way to have an equal fight. And so what these guys had to do was re-question baseball knowledge. They had to take everything apart and start over again.
It's a very like dialogue-driven film, even though there's a lot of like baseball scenes in it. But your performance, even though you're basically sitting in a chair talking and making phone calls, your performance is very kinetic. You always seem to be moving, you know, chewing ice, eating, moving your hands, throwing something. Is it challenging to do a kinetic performance in what is basically, you know, a managerial position kind of role?
You know, Billy's that way. Watching Billy, as soon as the phone rings, he becomes very myopic and laser-guided, and he himself becomes very intense. And when you approach a scene, I guess you're coming from the inside and the need to accomplish something, and that manifests itself in certain movements and eating and the need to you know, keep clawing till you get the answer you're looking for.
Let's talk about some of your other films. Let's start with Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino's recent film. It's set during World War II, and you play Lieutenant Aldo Raine, who's charged with putting together a team of like real killers to kill the Nazis. So here you are explaining the mission to your team.
My name is Lieutenant Aldo Raine, and I'm putting together a special team, and I need me 8 soldiers. 8 Jewish American soldiers. Now, y'all might have heard rumors about the Armada happening soon. Well, we'll be leaving a little earlier. We're going to be dropped into France dressed as civilians. And once we're in enemy territory, as a bushwhacking guerrilla army, we're going to be doing one thing and one thing only. Killing Nazis. Now, I don't know about y'all, but I sure as hell didn't come down from the goddamn Smoky Mountains, cross 5,000 miles of water, fight my way through half of Sicily, and jump out of a an aeroplane to teach the Nazis lessons in humanity. Nazi ain't got no humanity. They're the foot soldiers of a Jew-hating, mass-murdering maniac, and they need to be destroyed. That's why any and every sumbitch we find wearing a Nazi uniform, they're gonna die.
That's Brad Pitt in a scene from Inglourious Basterds. I like the way you say Nazis.
That's tasty stuff. Only from the mind of Quentin Tarantino.
Did the script say to pronounce Nazis Nazis?
No, it didn't say that, but we're from the same general neck of the woods, so we both understood.
Who, you and Lieutenant Aldo Raine, or you and Quentin Tarantino? Because
he's from
L.A., isn't he?
Yeah, but he's originally from Kentucky and has a lot of roots.
Okay.
Kentucky roots.
You have a scar on your neck in the film, and it looks like either you were strangled with a wire and survived, or your throat was slashed and you survived. Do you know what happened to your throat?
Yes, and he said it would never be explained in this film, and if he's ever to do what he called a prequel/sequel, then we'll reveal it then.
And is that a possibility?
He talks about it. You know, he's got several things percolating at once.
You grew up in Oklahoma and in Missouri, and mm-hmm. your family was Southern Baptist Evangelical?
Mm-hmm.
So
we grew up Southern Baptist, and then somewhere in my high school years, my family moved more towards the charismatic movement.
So what was your Christian background like? What was the emphasis like in church? How was that reflected in your upbringing?
Well, it was, you know, it was Sunday school and do good and Bible study and daily prayer. But it was always something I wrestled with personally. I was very curious about the world even at a young age, and I don't know at what point I became aware that other nations and other cultures didn't believe the same, and they believed in different religions. And my question is, well, why don't they get to go to heaven then? And the answer was always, well, everyone gets a chance, meaning at the Word of God as it was described to me then. And that didn't sit right with me. But it, you know, at the same time, in times of trouble or discourse, it's a great comfort. And it wasn't till I left home that I really came to the conclusion it didn't make sense to me for many other reasons than that.
Now, you studied journalism in college. What did you expect to become?
I wasn't really sure. I was just investigating it for myself. They have one of the best J schools in the country.
Oh, this is where?
University of Missouri.
Okay.
And it just came to the time of graduation, and everyone was, all my friends were committing to jobs, and I just realized I was not ready for that yet. And it just occurred to me that, having always lamented that there wasn't the possibility or career choice of being in films, that I could go to it. And once I struck that little bit of discovery, I packed up my car. I didn't graduate. I had 2 weeks left, and I moved out to L.A.
2 weeks is such a it's a blink of an eye.
I just felt I was done. I was done with it.
So you knew your mind.
Well, I knew where I wanted to go. I had a direction. I always liked those moments of epiphany when you have the next destination.
So you go to L.A. and then what? You get there, then what?
I get there with, you know, like the cliche goes, with my beat-up Datsun, and I had $275 to my savings, and I landed in Burbank, and I got the paper, and I found some extra agencies, and by, you know, the end of that week, I paid my $25 to join up, and I was an extra.
In what?
It started out in industrial films and commercials, and then, you know, you work your way up, and I guess the biggest film I had was, or I had, that's really, that's a funny way to put it, but it was Less Than Zero.
Oh, you were an extra in Less Than Zero?
Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed
that must,
it, man.
That must have been fun. I mean,
oh, it was so much fun. I just wanted to be around film, and suddenly I was on film, and I was on a set and watching how the guys, you know, how they do it.
So you start getting in films, and you get very famous. What was the strangest thing early on about actually not only being successful but being famous?
The strangest thing is suddenly being looked at and watched and judged in a way. I mean, I don't know what I was expecting. You're putting yourself in that ring. I just didn't think that far ahead. And I found it very discombobulating. I was very, very uncomfortable with the focus.
So did that make you want to be in the limelight any more or less?
No, I still wanted to crack this film thing I was in, but I was committed. You know, I think one of the lovely things about where I grew up is it's considered great hubris to talk about yourself. And yet, you know, as we sit here now, it's part of the business. And I find it actually interesting and cathartic in some way. But at that time, I mean, a good 10 years I wrestled with it.
About how much to share about yourself?
Yeah, I was very, very protective.
So you live in a world where money is so weird. I mean, like, you were able to sell the first pictures of the first child that Angelina Jolie gave birth to for $4.1 million to People magazine. And then, you donated the money to charity. You put the money to good use. But that's just, like, so weird to get that amount of money for
bizarre.
Photograph. It's crazy. It's like value's gone nuts. So
it's bizarre.
Yeah, it seems to me what you're trying to do is, like, at least try to take the value's gone nuts and put it to good use, put the money to good use.
Well, that was my feeling. I mean, I know some of these guys who are in that stockarazzi world, and you really have to separate them from the paparazzi in our industry. This is another breed. And they have their heroes who got the big scandalous shot, which just promotes more of that. So going into this, we knew, listen, it's a very strange thing to be selling photos of something that's very intimate and personal, and those of which you want to protect. We knew, we have to plan an escape every day to get out of the house, kind of a Mission Impossible with decoys, and that's the life we live in, and that's the one we asked for. So, but we knew there was a bounty on our head, and a huge bounty, and there would, we understand the lengths they go to, I don't think people do, to get that shot. So we figured, let's cut it off from the beginning, and instead of that money going to people I do not respect, that we would make some good out of it. And there's a nice thing about our situation.
So did it work? Did it head people off at the pass? Did it prevent you from being stalked in the way that you feared you would?
Yeah, it took that initial hit, absolutely.
So at least nobody else could claim that they had the first photo.
Right. And that's where the big bounty is.
That's where the big bucks are. Right. Mm. I interview people for a living. That's how I spend my time, you know, and I care what my guests have to say. I'm really interested in hearing how the choices people make when they're living their lives, why they do what they do, how they do what they do. At the same time, I don't really understand why everybody needs to know the intimate details of your personal life or your children's lives. And I imagine you don't really understand that either, but it's something you probably have to think about a whole lot more than I do. Do you have any answers to that? Like, why do people feel that they need to know or that they're entitled to know personal details
I divorce myself of it. I don't think about it. And as I say, I enjoy life much more.
Mm-hmm.
I do know there's a positive side to it. Let me put it this way, and let's see if it relates.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I had seen people I respected when I was first starting, just that brush with them meant something to me. Like, my day felt special.
Are there actors you felt that way about when you first met them?
Absolutely. I just, you know, again, just being around it, and like being on the set of Lesson Zero, I watched Robert Downey Jr. go by, and I thought, yeah, that's all right.
So can I squeeze in one more film clip before we have to end?
Yeah, sure.
Great. Okay, so this is Fight Club. And this became a real, like, cult favorite. And you star in this with Edward Norton, and he plays somebody who's been traveling on business, meets your character on a plane, and comes home to find his house has been destroyed. He calls you up, and then you meet in a bar, and then you basically make a strange request to him. You say, hit me. Here's the clip.
What do you want me to do? You just want me to hit you?
Come on. Do me just one favor.
Why?
Why? I don't know why. I don't know. Never been in a fight. You?
No, but that's a good thing.
No, it is not. How much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? I don't want to die without any scars. So come on, hit me before I lose my nerve.
Oh, God. This is crazy.
So go crazy. Let her rip.
Hey, I don't know about this.
I don't either, but who gives a shit? No one's watching. What do you care?
Wait, what? This is crazy. You want me to hit you?
That's right.
What, like in the face?
Surprise me.
This is so stupid.
It's my guest Brad Pitt with Edward Norton in a scene from Fight Club. So the character says, how much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? Have you been in fights? I mean, you've had to be in fights for movies. What about real life?
Not really. Not really. Not for a long time, which I'm grateful to say.
But even when you were young, did you?
Oh, certainly in my younger days, and they were always messy and scrappy and somewhat stupid.
Mm-hmm. So did you and Ed Norton end up hurting each other at all during the making of this film?
No, I don't think so. We mainly just had a laugh.
So how many people walk up to you and say, the first rule of Fight Club is not to talk about Fight Club?
No one.
Really?
No.
It's one of those like famous lines, which I think I just got a couple of words wrong in, but nevertheless.
Sometimes I'll get Tyler Durden, but nothing much more than that.
What do people say when they meet
I'm
you?
Just afraid, you know, people are doing things to my soup or, you know, the restaurant or something.
Do you have to worry about that?
I try not to.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I thank you very much.
Brad Pitt speaking to Terry Gross in 2011. His movie Moneyball is now out on DVD. Next week, jazz singer Catherine Russell will be taping a performance and interview with Terry Gross, which we'll broadcast in the next couple of weeks. Catherine Russell has a terrific new record called Strictly Romancin'. Here's a tune from the album.
Hello? Hello? Is this Harlem 77711? Hello, John. Is this you? I tried to phone you. I hope you ain't sick. But I'm checking out Mumbai. Nice to have known you. You were my big kick. But I'm checking out Mumbai. You tried no trick. You found a new chick. But I was too slick. I'm in the know, you got to go, the cake is all done. It's too bad I bliss, had to miss out like this. I'm checking out, goombay. Hey, John? Huh? Oh, no, you're breaking up, baby. Big kick, but I'm checking out.